This week on The Score, we have an exclusive interview with Roger Stone, one of the targets of the Mueller investigation. What does he have to say about politics and policy? We also talk with an expert on trade in Africa, and a historian describes the Lavender Scare. All this and more on The Score, so don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. Readers of the Bering Drift website know that last Saturday, The Score had an exclusive interview with political consultant Roger Stone, a longtime friend of President Trump, who has also been an informal advisor. Stone is under indictment, facing trial later this year in federal court over allegations stemming from the Mueller investigation about collusion and obstruction of justice. He's not allowed to talk about that, but Roger Stone has plenty more to say about politics and public policy. Here's the first part of my interview with Roger Stone during his visit to Richmond, Virginia last weekend. Roger Stone, thank you for joining us on The Score from Bering Drift. You've advised a lot of political candidates over the years. Have you ever thought about running for office yourself?
No, I'm more interested in the strategic aspects of politics. I like to use my talents to elect people, men and women, that I believe in. Under President Richard Nixon, I had a brief stint at the Office of Economic Opportunity under Don Rumsfeld. And it didn't take me long to figure out that I hated government. It was politics I was interested in, and the art and science, and it really is a science, of getting elected. And, of course, the manner in which you communicate with voters, and therefore the manner in which men and women get elected, has changed radically from the days of the handbill and the newspaper. The newspapers were handed from person to person, moving their way west, to the radio, then television, then network television, then cable, and then, of course, the internet. Each one of those things brought a revolution in how our politics work. And that's what fascinates me. And obviously, I started out as a hardcore Goldwater conservative, but also very much a libertarian. I'm a great believer in individual liberty and personal freedom, and, of course, the right to privacy, and therefore I've had the luxury in the last couple of decades to only work for those people that I believed in. When I was a much younger political consultant, I kind of had to take any business that came in the door. They were all Republicans, but Republicans of various stripes. So I have no interest in ever running for public office.
Your answer sort of anticipated one of the questions I had in mind. That is, when you were working in the 1970s, how would things have been different if you had had access to social media?
Oh, they would have been completely different. Had the alternative media based in the internet existed in 1974, Richard Nixon would have survived Watergate. But you had a monolithic mainstream media that was even more narrow then than it is today. Three major networks, only two or three national newspapers, and a couple national news magazines. And if they said something happened, it happened. And if they said something didn't happen or they didn't cover something, then it was like the tree falling in the forest. So Nixon had no platform to punch back. Nixon had no platform to launch a counteroffensive and make it clear that he was taken down. Yes, he made mistakes, but he was essentially taken down by the same forces that seek to take Trump down today. Little did the military-industrial complex of the time know that they were electing a peacemaker. They didn't want a strategic arms limitation with the Soviets. They didn't want an end to the war in Vietnam. They did not want an opening to China. They did not want an end to the military draft. Nixon did all those things. And therefore, he was very much a threat to the Pentagon and to the intelligence agencies. He deeply distrusted the CIA because he knew of their involvement in the Kennedy assassination. He deeply distrusted the Pentagon because he learned in his first year in office they were spying on him, that a naval yeoman named Radford, who was posted in the Navy liaison, or I should say the military liaison office in the White House, was going around at night rifling through desks, photographing documents, and sending them to Admiral Thomas Moorer, who was the head of the Joint Chiefs. The Joint Chiefs didn't trust Nixon. He was interested in peace. They were interested in war.
You mentioned how social media would have been different for Nixon. President Reagan had a way of getting around the media and talking directly to the American people, certainly not to the extent that President Trump does it, but did Reagan have a magic touch as far as that goes?
Well, his communicative skills were so superior. While he, say, for example, stood for the same things as Barry Goldwater, he was able to state them and present them in a friendlier, sunnier, more optimistic way. And he also took advantage of the failures of Jimmy Carter. He was not favored to win that election. He really put it away in the last 10 days. The debates were a major factor in that. There's no way for the media to filter out the debate. It gets wall-to-wall coverage. And he was a superb performer. So I think that his ability to communicate, particularly in the presidential debates, allowed him to avoid the fate of Goldwater. Goldwater is a perfect example of what happens when the media decides to brand you as something you are not. A warmonger, a maniac, a lunatic, a Nazi. Well, he was none of those things.
And he wasn't a psychopath either.
He was none of those things. Lyndon Johnson was perhaps, really was a psychopath, a pill-popping, alcoholic, epically corrupt murderer. If you read my book, The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ, I attribute at least 18 politically or otherwise motivated murders to Lyndon Johnson. Not just the murder of JFK, but the murder of others who could identify either voter fraud or epic corruption on Johnson's part.
Do you think that Ronald Reagan or Barry Goldwater, or for that matter, Gerald Ford, would feel welcome in today's Republican Party?
I think they would. I frankly think that they would be more welcome in the party and feel more comfortable in the party today than they would in the party of George H.W. Bush. In other words, I think the Trump nomination and election is the hostile takeover of the Republican Party, snatching it back from the country club neocon wing that really made the Republican Party almost indistinguishable from Democrats. What is the foreign policy difference between George Bush and Bill Clinton? None. Donald Trump was elected because he's a non-interventionist. He understands the concept of peace through strength. Build your strength. Don't go around the world looking for trouble, but build your strength as a deterrent to those who would take on America. That's Reagan-esque. That's Goldwaterism at its core. Whereas the Bush-Clinton philosophy of meddling in the Middle East where we have no business, and foreign wars in, say, Syria, Iran, or Iraq, pardon me, Afghanistan, that's the bipartisan neocon disease that still infects the State Department and our intelligence agencies.
We were talking about communications, and recently it's come to light that Barack and Michelle Obama have formed a film production company. What kinds of things do you think they might use their film production company to entice the American people to believe?
First of all, the election of Donald Trump shows you the seamlessness between the pop culture and our political culture. And therefore, prior to Trump's election, to become elected president of the United States, one needed to be a senator or a governor or a general. Now, the best-known businessman, the number one proponent of free enterprise and entrepreneurial capitalism and success in the world, has become president of the United States. The blurring of that line and the power of Hollywood and the fact that our entertainment centers are now politically correct has bred, I think, the ability to use entertainment to indoctrinate the masses. Now, I am one who believes that the Democratic field for president is not yet complete.
Yeah, there are 22 candidates now, which is more than the number of horses in the Kentucky Derby.
And none of them will be the nominee, in my opinion. Joe Biden is up to his keister in Spygate. He was in all of the key meetings in which there was a discussion of the illicit and illegal, Chris Cuomo, illegal use of the power and the authority and the capability of the state to surveil the Republican nominee for president. This is, of course, a scandal far worse than Watergate. It's an abuse of power that is unconstitutional and a crime. And therefore, Biden is present in all these key meetings. And therefore, I would argue that he's a co-conspirator. He also is responsible for the mass incarceration of more young black people than anybody still living, because he's the author of most of the sweeping war on drugs legislation that was championed by Bill Clinton, but who Biden, as chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, authored. That means that the penalties for the first time nonviolent offense of possession of small amounts of drugs brings a harsher mandatory penalty than the, for example, in the possession of rock cocaine, than it does for the possession of powdered cocaine. So in other words, if you're a poor black kid and you're caught with rock cocaine, you're going away for a long time. But if you're a rich white lawyer and you're caught with powdered cocaine, the mandatory penalties are less harsh. Joe Biden is a hardcore racist.
That's just a taste. We'll have more from Roger Stone during the second half of the program.
Did you miss a previous episode of The Score? Look for our podcast at BearingDrift.com.
6 out of the 10 fastest growing economies in the world are in Africa, yet there are still obstacles to greater growth on that continent. I spoke to Alexander Hammond of African Liberty about changes that are happening in Africa that could improve the prospects for economic expansion and reducing poverty. Over the years, one of the things I've identified as an impediment to economic growth and prosperity in Africa, and I think other people will agree with this, is the lack of intracontinental trade. There just isn't a lot going on. I'll give you the example, Gabon. It imports 90% of its food from Europe, mostly France, and yet it has hardly any trade at all with its neighbor, Cameroon. They just don't import or export anything. What are the prospects for more trade within Africa as opposed to just being a source of commodities exports to North America and Europe?
Yeah, so at the moment, Africa has a very low percentage of intra-regional trade when we compare it to the rest of the world. Currently, intercontinental trade accounts for just 18% of Africa's GDP, compared to Europe and Asia at 69 and 59%, respectively. So with the African Continental Free Trade Agreement, which has reached its 22 member state minimum earlier this month when the Gambia signed on and ratified it, hopefully this can increase the amount of intercontinental trade happening in Africa.
We're talking to Alexander Hammond, who's a senior fellow at African Liberty, about African trade. Has this trade agreement been preceded by economic liberalization, or is it a precursor to more economic liberalization in Africa?
So I really hope it's a precursor to more economic liberalization within Africa. Going forward, so it's currently got 22 members signed on, and that means in July the 7th, when African heads of states meet, it will actually be implemented. Once it's implemented, the United Nations Economic Commission on Africa predicts that interregional trade could increase by 52% in just a few years. That 52% could double when the final 10% of tariffs are removed, because when the agreement comes into place, 90% of tariffs on goods traded between member states are instantly removed. So that has huge potential to boost the economy of a region.
I don't want to be skeptical of those figures, which seem to me to be rather optimistic. There's another obstacle to trade within Africa, and that is a lack of infrastructure. There simply aren't enough roads and railroads and waterways to move goods from one African country to another. Do you see any improvements in that area of progress?
Yeah, so I'd guess part of this agreement has potential to increase infrastructure, because I believe it makes it easier to trade with the rest of the world. Having all African nations under one single customs union, makes it far more incentive for the United States, the EU, China to trade, because they'd only have to make one set of trade deals as opposed to 55 separate trade deals with each individual tiny African country. There's also more incentive because it will be one single market of almost $3 trillion, 1.3 billion people. But how that could increase infrastructure is because it will potentially invite external countries in, and they have far more incentive to improve and create infrastructural projects than just give out loans through the IMF, World Bank, or through China's current export bank.
Well, what are the provisions of this free trade agreement? Is it lowering tariffs across the board? What other incentives do countries have to join in?
So one incentive which we just mentioned was potential to increase trade with the rest of the world. Interregional trade will make it far easier for goods to flow between nations, and that's currently a huge problem in Africa, is that trying to drive a lorry across a few countries takes weeks, if not months in some cases. But the African Continental Free Trade Area all falls within the African Union's Agenda 2063, which is this big liberalization project to try and remove boundaries, not just economic, but also one of our ideas is to create the African Union passport. So that means people within Africa can travel freely without any need for visas between member states. And that has huge potential to liberalize the economy further and really boost how connected the continent is.
Well, the question of migrant labor is an important one for Africa, and that leads to my next question, which are the two largest economies of Africa involved in this trade agreement, Nigeria and South Africa?
So South Africa, which is currently 16% of the continent's GDP, is ratified and is part of it. But at the moment, Nigeria is not. Nigeria represents 17% of Africa's entire GDP, is the most populous country, and it's not part. It's in its early days, in 2012, it had somewhat support for the agreement, but people have speculated that the National Labour Congress, which is the biggest trade union in the country, has kind of lobbied the government into not backing this deal. But saying that, there is some potential leeway. Just a couple of months ago, Zimbabwe said they wouldn't ratify the agreement for at least 15 years, and then a month later they ratified it. So things change quickly, but currently it seems the trade unions have got their hold over it and want to protect their domestic industries.
Is the aim of this organization, I guess you could call it an organization, or a regime, is it the aim to include all the countries of Africa, or is it just Sub-Saharan Africa, or just a portion of Sub-Saharan Africa? What's the ultimate goal?
So they want as many countries as possible involved from the African Union. The African Union is currently made up of 55 member states, and they're trying to get as many as possible. Currently it's at 22, but that's likely to increase in the coming months as more and more countries slowly ratify it and pass it through their domestic governments. And I think a great part of this is that the African Union was initially set up the predecessor to the African Union was the Organization of African Unity. And that set up in 1963, and it was heavily influenced by Kwame Nkrumah, who was the first leader of Ghana. Mm-hmm. He was a socialist. He described himself as a Marxist socialist. Many people called him the father of African socialism. He encouraged many other African states to pursue independence in order to have a complete ownership of the economy by the state. And a stream of African countries followed him. In 1958, Toro of Guinea became independent and pursued a socialist road. So did Senghor of Senegal, Kieti of Mali in 1960, Kwando of Zambia. And the organization of African unity was partly created by Nkrumah in order to have a united socialist Africa, because he believed that was necessary for some African personality. So just to see the way the organization of African unity has transformed from its initially socialist plan into the more liberalizing group we see today. And last year, when an African Continental Free Trade Area was first introduced, and it was introduced by Paul Kagame, who was a president of Rwanda at the time. He was also the leader of the AU at the time. And he described himself as an avid free trader. And that's an amazing, amazing transformation. It's still very early days since independence in Africa. So the future, I'm excited and it's bright.
Yeah, it's very unusual to hear an African strongman like Kagame describe himself as a free trader, because those seem to be opposing ideas. I'm a dictator, but I'm in favor of free trade.
Yeah, I agree with you, but similarly, the president of Niger said when Kagame first introduced the agreement, it was really easy to have other leaders sign up, because he said, most leaders already want to create a free trade area in Africa. And when he introduced it immediately, 44 of 55 signed up. That doesn't mean ratified, because ratified means it goes through the parliament into law. But 44 immediately signed up. Currently, 52 of 55 have signed up. So it's not just the necessarily strongmen of Kagame, but the entire region, the whole, has more positive outlook on free trade.
Yeah, and I suppose that the more free trade there is, that means more free movement of individuals and more free movement of ideas and information, which will help undermine some of these more authoritarian countries in Africa. The economics has a political impact.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that completely. What I think we should note, though, is free trade is great, but free trade isn't enough in of itself. It's great to have free trade, but if you have nothing to trade in the first place, mm-hmm. it is worthless. And the way to have something to trade in the first place is to have strong rule of law, strong property rights, and that will really encourage external investment. Because without property rights and without rule of law, no external country or countries within Africa will want to trade with each other, because their investments won't be protected. So that's crucial. And then once that happens, trade can flourish.
And that leads to another problem that may exist. And that's that most of what Africa produces is in the commodities area, whether we're talking about mining and minerals or timber or oil. There's not a lot of manufacturing, not a lot of value added going on. So in order to have trade within countries of similar economic standards, they have to be producing something that the other country wants.
Yeah, so one potential benefit of the trade area is that currently, when African countries trade with each other, they typically trade in more manufactured goods. And when they trade with the external world, it's more commodities-based. So therefore, the potential of the trade area to increase intra-African trade has potential to boost the manufacturing sector, to increase their industries, and kind of kickstart the African Industrial Revolution, if you will.
And this is what happened in Europe after 1956, what is now the European Union in its various incarnations. They were exporting commodities, oil or coal and steel, and then that became what we now know as the EU.
Yeah, and exactly the same with Asia in the 1980s and 90s. Mm-hmm. So this is, I hope, the beginning of the industrialization process which the continent needs to hopefully develop into a middle-income region.
Last question. We don't have much time left. How does this interlock with American economic relations with Africa, particularly with regard to the African Growth and Opportunity Act, which is a system of preferences?
So I think it's absolutely great news for American trade preference. In December, John Bolton introduced his African strategy, and that basically said we want to be more selective with aid, and we want to increase commercial ties. So therefore, being able to trade with a single market and a customs union increases far more commercial ties and reduces the necessity for aid. And that will also protect African consumers, because with the US and the EU too reconsidering unilateral trade preference schemes. For example, last year, the US, with no warning, said, we're not going to import any Rwandan clothes. So suddenly the textile industry in Rwanda suffered a huge shock. So being able to trade commercially as opposed to having those preferential trade schemes will be good for America, because it's just a more universal trade scheme, and it will be protect African countries from the hit and miss, willy-nilly nature of these arrangements.
Well, Alexander Hammond, thank you for your comments today and instructing us on what's going on in Africa in terms of free trade. I'm glad you were able to join us again on The Score.
Thank you for having me.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com.
David Johnson is a professor of history at the University of South Florida. His book, The Lavender Scare, has been turned into a documentary film that opens in theaters and premieres on television next month. In this excerpt from our telephone interview, he explains what The Lavender Scare was.
David, let's start first with The Lavender Scare, which you published a few years ago, and it's now been transformed into a documentary film. I think a lot of people would be surprised to learn that during the 1950s, more Americans lost their jobs because of their sexual orientation than for being communists. And there was this thing called the Red Scare, which we associate with Joseph McCarthy. But there was also the Lavender Scare. Where did that term come from? When was it first used? And give me sort of the nutshell explanation of what it was all about.
Well, the Lavender Scare was this fear that I argue kind of permeated Cold War political culture, this idea that gays and lesbians had infiltrated the federal government and they posed a threat to national security, and that they needed to be removed from public service. At the time, in the 50s, they didn't call this the Lavender Scare, but lavender was the color associated with the gay community then. It doesn't actually get used until about the 90s. The beginnings of kind of gay and lesbian historical studies, right when I was going to grad school.
So the term was not used in the 1950s, but it was used about 40 years later, and then it became the title of your book. And that was published when? About 10 years ago?
Right, 2004.
Oh, okay. It's been a while, and now it's a movie. And I saw the documentary film, The Lavender Scare, at the Virginia Film Festival towards the end of 2017. But apparently it was a work in progress at that time, and it's about ready to be released more generally to theaters around the country. Give me some information about that.
Right. I'm very excited about it. It's been a long time in the making. Probably about 8 or 10 years in the making. It was at film festivals 2 years ago, about 50 film festivals, and won a bunch of Best Documentary Feature awards. But you're right, the producer, Josh Howard, who used to produce for 60 Minutes, has tinkered with it a bit. He now has what we call the celebrity version. It has Glenn Close narrating. Cynthia Nixon's voice is in it, David Hyde Pierce. And it will open in theaters in New York and Los Angeles in June, I think it's June 6th or June 7th. And then it will air on PBS on June 18th.
Oh, it's going to be on television. I didn't realize that. That's we'll mark our calendars.
That was actually just officially announced today.
Oh, so this is a scoop.
This is a scoop. So everyone will get to see it, yes.
That sounds great. And does the film contain any information that was not in your book?
In some ways it does, because, the book was, well, first it was actually my dissertation in graduate school, and, I was doing lots of research in Washington and other places, but, as a sort of struggling academic, I had limited resources. But when Josh Howard took on the project, he had some more resources and a research assistant, and so he was able to find people, mostly, fired gay and lesbian civil servants, and interview them. He also found some of the security officials who oversaw the Lavender Scare in the 50s and interviewed them. So in some ways it expands on the book.
That's an important component to keep in mind. And the interviews are very interesting, and some of them are quite poignant, as I recall. And I'm sure you encountered that yourself when you were doing research, that you met some people who had very horrible stories to tell about how they were treated by their own government as people who just wanted to do their jobs.
Yeah, some of them are really heartbreaking. I mean, it was, for a lot of these folks, it wasn't just, losing a job and, moving on to another job. It was their whole career paths were stymied. They couldn't find a job in their chosen career. They certainly couldn't find one anywhere else in the government, and the private sector, was essentially following the lead of the federal government then. People like Frank Kameny, who's fired from the federal government in 57 with a PhD in astronomy from Harvard, he can't find a job in astronomy in 1957 at the dawn of the space race because he can't get a security clearance.
Yeah, it's a ridiculous waste of talent for over 40 years, because in essence, the Lavender Scare, the exclusion of gay and lesbian employees from the federal government doesn't end until, 1996, something like that?
Right, it doesn't officially and completely end, right, until the Clinton administration. There are some victories along the way. There's an important court victory in 1969 that basically forces the civil service to change its policy. But the national security agencies, the CIA and the FBI, they continue to consider gay people a threat to national security up until the 90s.
And things have changed so much. Nowadays, the CIA and other government agencies have booths at gay pride festivals where they're trying to recruit people to work for them.
Exactly. It's quite a change.
On next week's show, we'll hear more from David Johnson about the Lavender Scare, as well as about his new book, Buying Gay. Be sure to listen next week for the rest of our conversation.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
I know you've been waiting to hear what more Roger Stone has to say about modern-day politics, including his opinions about Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, and Michelle Obama. That's right, he has predictions about Michelle Obama that may surprise you. Here's the rest of my conversation with Roger Stone in Richmond last weekend.
Joe Biden is a hardcore racist, and I think that he's going to have a very hard time in the Democratic primaries once that is made clear. He's a total fraud. I mean, he cannot see that he comes across as a loudmouth blowhard. And in Delaware, the people who he has stiffed, the hairdressers, the tradesmen, the small businessmen, the merchants who he has run up huge bills with but refuses to pay, they're lining up to make TV commercials against him. Middle class Joe has stiffed working people. He's a total epic fraud. And the corruption of his son Hunter makes Paul Manafort look like St. Thomas Aquinas. So bring Joe Biden on. He's got a glass jaw. He's an intellectual and physical lightweight with more Botox than half the people in Hollywood.
So it seems you think Joe Biden would be an easy mark in a campaign in 2020.
Joe, I really think Trump would pulverize Joe Biden. He is responsible He's been wrong on every major foreign and domestic policy issue for the last 30 years. And he can't see himself. He can't see what a jackass he comes across of. He doesn't have the common touch. Middle-class Joe lives in the wealthiest suburb of Wilmington called Greenville, and he stiffs people. He doesn't pay his bills. Those will make epic TV commercials. To go back to your question, I think that Michelle Obama is the most likely nominee of the Democratic Party.
Really?
I've thought this for some time. Now, as you know, she insists she's not running. There's the strongest indication yet that she's going to be a candidate. That's how it works. The Obamas continue to control the machinery of the Democratic Party. The only other candidate on the horizon here who I think has to be taken serious, of course, is Bernie Sanders for several reasons. One, the socialist wing of the Democratic Party is in the ascendancy. The Democratic Party of John F. Kennedy and Harry Truman, the party that stood up for Israel, the party that was anti-communist, the party that supported free speech, the party that supported civil liberties, that party is dead. That party no longer exists. And there's also an enormous built-in advantage in running for president previously and losing. Reagan could never have been nominated in 1980 if he had not challenged Ford in 1976. Bernie Sanders has a ready-made organization in all 50 states. He has an epically large and effective donor list. He has the stature of having run before. That guarantees him coverage everywhere he goes. And then you have candidates like Eric Swalwell, who's based his candidacy solely on the proposition that the Trump campaign colluded with the Russians, which now the special counsel says didn't happen.
Who is the candidate in the field that you think President Trump should most be afraid of? The one who would be the biggest challenge
to run against? I think Michelle Obama would be a very tough competitor.
Well, assuming she doesn't run.
Well, I guess I would have to say Sanders for a couple of reasons. First of all, given Sanders' views on both war and trade, at least the positions he used to have before he endorsed Hillary Clinton and became a multimillionaire. You see, Sanders and his wife formed a media commission placement company, and they placed all of the ads for his presidential campaign, pocketing millions of dollars. That, by the way, is perfectly legal, but I think it's called entrepreneurial capitalism. Very odd for a man who's a socialist. He now owns 3 homes and drives a top-of-the-line Mercedes. I don't really think he's a socialist anymore, but his non-interventionist views, if he still holds them, his views on trade, which are very similar to the president's, I think those would challenge some within the president's base. Remember, Donald Trump got 1 out of 3 Sanders voters in the general election of 3.5 years ago. And therefore, I think Sanders' populist appeal as an outsider is somewhat similar to the president's appeal as an outsider. I think at this point, it's a mistake to look at our politics as Republican versus Democrat, because that's not the way to look at it. It's the insiders versus an outsider. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump is the first outsider president we've had since Ronald Reagan. And you have seen the two-party duopoly and the elites of both parties team up to try to frustrate his presidency. And despite that, you have a modern economic miracle. You have the fastest wage growth in American history. You have unemployment at record low levels. You have a record number of jobs created, over almost 5 million new jobs. You have 650,000 manufacturing jobs. Another almost 250,000 jobs created just in the last quarter. A record stock market, even with the corrections. Billions of dollars coming back into the country to be invested here, to expand businesses here, to create jobs here. So, and that's despite the implacable opposition of the two-party insiders in both houses of Congress and their handmaidens in the corporate-owned media to try to thwart everything the president does. Now, I think he should have enacted his tax cuts and his regulatory cuts prior to the ban on, you know, certain countries having people travel here, the so-called travel ban. I think the economic miracle would have come even a little bit sooner, but it will fully manifest itself by the next election. absent a willful effort by the Federal Reserve to tank the economy, which, by the way, we saw in 1974. There was an effort to tank the economy as the backdrop for Nixon's impeachment, and it was quite successful. This is why he keeps calling out the Fed. It's actually very smart. By the way, find the Constitution. Where's the section about the Federal Reserve? Oh, it's not there.
One more question about the 2020 Democratic field. Have you been surprised by the amount of attention that South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg has been getting?
No, not really, because the LGBT community is an important constituency in that party, both in terms of money and in terms of votes. Yet, the Democratic Party will not stand up to radical Islam, which favors taking gay people and throwing them off the top of buildings or killing them or burning them alive. So it's kind of a contradiction there. I'm not surprised. It's become one of the most important constituencies beyond labor and minority groups, organized minorities, who don't represent the growing black middle class, in my opinion, within the Democratic Party.
You mentioned earlier Joe Biden's role in ramping up the war on drugs.
Yes.
Do you think the Republican Party will run on legalizing marijuana next year?
They certainly should. I mean, look, I am, as everyone knows, a fan and an acolyte of Richard Nixon. But if you will read either of my books on Nixon, I ascribe the war on drugs with the closing of the gold window, wage and price controls, as his three greatest errors, putting the handling of Watergate aside. I think the war on drugs has been an ignominious, racist failure. It's destroyed lives. It's destroyed families. It rehabilitates no one. But more, just as importantly, it's costing the taxpayers billions of dollars to incarcerate people who are not violent. I applaud the fact that in 2016, the president took the position that he supported the state's rights to legalize marijuana if they saw fit. He didn't say he favored legalization. He said it was up to the states. I have a lot of respect for that position. Now I think he should take marijuana off of the Schedule 1 DEA list, which he can do with the stroke of a pen. And I think he should support the legislation by Cory Booker and Matt Gaetz and others to just legalize cannabis. The states, as you know, 39 states now have some form of legalization, mostly for medicinal purposes. That's a good start. As a radical libertarian, I favor total legalization. This is an issue that cuts right to the heart of the Democratic base. The president's moving in the right direction. As you know, he is supporting the federal legislation by Senator Cory Gardner of Colorado to protect state legalized marijuana. Firing Jeff Sessions was one of the best things he's ever done. That guy was a hillbilly throwback in terms of his attitudes about cannabis. So, yes, I think the president should run on that.
I've heard rumors about that for several months now, but I think you probably have some more inside knowledge than anyone else I've talked to. What are some other issues that you think need to be emphasized over the next couple of years, whether we're talking about presidential campaigns or congressional campaigns going into 2020?
Going back to the difference between Biden and Donald Trump, again, Joe Biden is one of the authors of the war on drugs, but it's Donald Trump who actually brought us criminal justice reform to reform the harsh mandatory sentences that were penalizing poor people and were giving no one a second chance. Enough people don't know about that. The president needs to talk about it. Now, this is something that I have been urging on him for 30 years, and I would concede that Kim Kardashian got his attention better than I did. But it doesn't matter how it got done. He did the right thing. He did an important thing. I think he did a great thing. It's one of the issues he should run on as an accomplishment.
It's certainly important to have criminal justice issues addressed by Congress. Congress seems to be so reluctant to look like they're soft on crime.
Well, it's interesting to see the Democrats saying Attorney General Bill Barr lied to Congress. That equates him with Richard Nixon, and he should be impeached or removed. Really, their party just got caught in abuse of power in which they were using the authority and capability of the state to spy on Donald Trump and his campaign. There's your constitutional crisis. There's your abuse of the Constitution. and the president and the attorney general both say this is being investigated. I have a personal interest in this. It has nothing to do with my current legal problems. But the New York Times reported on January 20th, 2017, that I was among three associates of Donald Trump who were under surveillance by the Obama administration during the 2016 election. My lawyers filed almost 30 individual Freedom of Information Act requests. The government has stonewalled giving us any information regarding whether I was under surveillance. I believe if there's a full declassification of this information by the president, we're going to learn that I was under surveillance. I'd like to know what the probable cause is. I have no Russian contacts. I was not in touch with anybody from Russia during the campaign or representing the Russians. So I think I was targeted for political reasons. Again, this has nothing to do with my current legal issues. None of this is alleged in that by me or by the government. It's a side issue, but one that I have a great interest in seeing resolved.
Going back, 30, 40 years, you and your partners transformed the lobbying industry by creating a one-stop shop for lobbying, campaign consulting, fundraising, getting rid of the silos that existed in Washington. What do you think the ultimate result of that was? Because you had a lot of imitators.
Well, first of all, the silos never really, really existed. Here's the difference. Tommy Boggs, the big Democratic lobbyist, would bundle a couple $100,000 and give it to Joe Biden. Then he would come lobby him. I would help Arlen Specter get elected, and then after he was elected, I would come lobby him. How are they different? I don't think they're different, although I couldn't command the kind of cash that Tommy could. So everything we did was legal. Yes, we represented some foreign governments, every one of them pro-U.S. and pro-Western and pro-democracy, or anti-communist at a minimum. Which was, of course, this was at a time when the Soviet Union was still in business and still oppressing people, Christians, gays, women, and so on. So I do think we transformed the culture of Washington, but we weren't doing anything that hadn't already been done. We were just more open and honest about it.
The president has been very open of his criticism of Saturday Night Live and Alec Baldwin impersonating him. What did you think of Steve Martin impersonating you?
You know, the worst part is I really like Steve Martin. I've always been a big Steve Martin fan, but I don't act anything like that. So I hope that, and he says he's going to do it again. I saw him on one of the late night talk shows with one of those guys who isn't funny. I forget which one.
Probably Seth Meyers.
Yes, it was Seth Meyers. The guy's never funny. Hate to say it. He's not as bad as Trevor Noah. It must be really hard to be a comedian and literally never be funny. But I hope he will study it. But look, I have now been memorialized or immortalized on Family Guy, on Saturday Night Live. There's a new series in which a guy has a Roger Stone tattoo on his back. That's kind of funny.
That's a tribute.
It is. And therefore, I guess these are all flattering things. I don't know. I do know my name ID is an all-time high. And today, as I visit Richmond, even now, I can't walk within three blocks of here without being recognized, which is both good and bad.
It depends on who's recognizing you.
Well, in all honesty, since the raid on my home by the FBI, which everybody saw on CNN, public reaction when I travel the streets, whether it's New York, whether it's Richmond, is actually overwhelmingly positive. Obviously, as you know, there's a gag order in my case, and I can't discuss the specifics of my case. I'll have a lot to say when I get to court. The judge is right. That's the right place to do the talking, and I'll have plenty to say at an appropriate time. But I do appreciate the fact that over 42,000 people have now given to my legal defense fund, which, by the way, is at stonedefensefund.com. The economic impact on me and my family has been devastating. I've lost my home. I've lost my savings. I had to sell my car. I've lost most of my insurance. I make a living by reading and speaking, but the things that people would pay me to read and speak about right now are the very topics that I can't address. It's been very hard on my family, but I'm not going to change my plea. I'm not going to plead guilty to something I didn't do. I have pled not guilty. I will fight for total vindication. I'm charged with lying to Congress. I think people know that. And I will provide a robust and aggressive and vigorous legal defense when the time comes. There is a tsunami now of fake news. The CNNs and the MSNBCs of the world understand that I'm under a gag order, so they can say anything about me they want. Many of these things patently false, just not true, knowing that I can't address them right now. But there'll be an appropriate time that I can address them. And again, anybody who wants to help me should recognize that I'm looking at $2 million plus for a legal defense.
A minimum.
At a minimum. And probably they're now telling me more because I'm going to need certain experts, assuming the matter goes to trial, which I expect it will. And many, many, many people praying for me, many people donating, the support of the American people, the support of the president's supporters, the president's words of encouragement in numerous tweets. These things are very heartening. And I will fight for total vindication.
And that brings me to my last question, which is, what are the circumstances that brought you to Richmond today?
I am speaking, quite controversially, at a gentleman's club tonight. Why? Because they invited me. Why? Because I need to raise money for my legal defense. Now, a year ago, I was speaking at the prestigious Oxford Political Union in London, and tonight I'm speaking at the Paper Moon Southside, but there's no hypocrisy here. I have always been a libertarian Republican. I've always been a strong supporter of free speech and free expression. People are coming to hear me speak tonight, and also my friend Kristen Davis, the famous Manhattan madam, who's now an evangelical Christian. And this is not about sex. It's about free speech. As you probably know, the local chapters of Antifa have vowed to stop me from speaking, yet they say I'm the fascist. Kind of weird. I think they're communists, and I think they're the ones fomenting violence. I'm against violence, and I encourage people not to act violently in their political reactions. It's not the way to go. So that's what brings me to Richmond. I think we will have a good time. I will get a chance to speak. I'll get a chance to meet a lot of supporters. I'll be signing books, my book Stone's Rules, my book The Making of the President 2016, How Donald Trump Orchestrated an American Revolution. I will be selling the iconic Roger Stone Did Nothing Wrong t-shirts, which, by the way, you can get at 1776.shop. I have sold 15,000 of these. The money goes to benefit my legal defense. And I was wearing this t-shirt at the time I was arrested.
I saw the picture.
I think most of the people in America saw the picture, thanks to CNN. And I'll be selling some of my Roger Stone paperweights, which started as a running gag. It was just a rock in which I signed my name on a flare. It's a Roger Stone. Get it?
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't selling any of them until Talking Points Memo and Rolling Stone and Huffington Post mocked me. We sold almost 20,000 of these at $10 a piece. And you can get one at stonecoldtruth.com by going to the shop. But I'll be selling those as well. And I'll be posing for selfies for anybody who wants one. So I look forward to a good time in Richmond. It's been a long time. I haven't been here since Mills Godwin was governor.
That's a long time.
It is a long time.
My guess is that the people who are coming to see you at the Paper Moon Gentlemen's Club tonight are probably those who normally don't go to that that club for
Yeah, I think it's important that people understand that there may be exotic dancing going on in the next room, but you're not required to go to the next room. We're using it as a venue for speaking and meeting, a social occasion, if you will. Now, if you want to go to the next room where the exotic dancing is going on, you're perfectly allowed to, but that's not part of our program.
Yeah, you'd prefer to get the tips that the dancers would get.
I would. If I leave with a lot of $1 bills tonight, you'll know I was successful.
Well, Roger Stone, thank you so much. You've given us a half hour of your time while you're in Richmond. Thank you for joining us on The Score from Bering Drift.
Thank you, and God bless you.
That's all the time we have this week on The Score. For all the writers and editors at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. Be sure to come back next week to hear the rest of my conversation with historian David Johnson. We'll also have more news, reviews, and interviews. Thank you for listening, and visit us at BearingDrift.com.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at RickSincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bearing Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit BearingDrift.com.